those with subsections. Cool.
Okay,
here we go. And welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, also broadcast live on UPRN 105.3 New Orleans. I'm your host, DeAndrew, and tonight my guest is author, researcher, and historian, Art Campbell. But before we get started, a couple of announcements. I'd like to remind everyone that you can also listen to the UFO Paranormal Radio Network on your cell phone by calling 704-631-4060 and entering the four-digit station ID code 2899. I also remind everybody of the Truckers UFO Reporting Center. If you're a long-haul trucker out there and you have a sighting and just don't know where to report it, well, here you go. That's the National Truckers UFO Reporting Center at www.tuforc.com. Art Campbell has served his country during the Korean War at a naval shore installation and with a fleet electronics training unit aboard the aircraft carrier USS Boxer. After leaving the Navy in the mid-1950s, he became active in UFO investigation and research and started a NICAP affiliate in Kansas City, Missouri. Working with NICAP's Donald E. Kehoe in 1958-59, he was involved in a letter sent to ex-President Truman from Kehoe in 1959. And tonight, UFO historian Art Campbell and I will be discussing his research into the question of, did President Eisenhower go to Holloman Air Force Base as secret for the possibility of meeting with extraterrestrials? And welcome, Art, and I'm glad to have you back again this week.
Well, it's glad to be here.
I was reading through your website, in which I want to let everyone know that the Eisenhower-Holloman section of your website is now up and running again, correct?
Yes, that's right, yes. Get through I'll give you the website. It's just take a crash book, and it's www.crashbook. Yeah, I'm sorry. Let's try it again. I'll need my own website. www.ufocrashbook.com. UFOcrashbook.com. And that'll get you to the Google headings. And I'm the second one down on Eisenhower, another one, which is my homepage, but I sort of have two homepages. So when they get to that, they see a lady pointing to a big airplane, that's there at the right place.
And I was reading over it, and that's quite a story.
It is, and I was getting ready to kind of retire. I've been, I started this whole research in the mid-50s, and I took about 30 years out for teaching. I was teaching in other small communities in Colorado and on the west coast of Northern California places, and there wasn't a lot of activity going on, and so I didn't kind of get back into UFO research until about 1989, 30 years later. And so I've been pretty active in the last 20 years or so. And I got a letter from a gentleman who had heard me talk on a talk show a while back and said that if you're interested and wanted to know about a secret trip to, that he'd seen Eisenhower's plane at Holloman Air Force Base in February of 1955. He didn't get to see the president, but he saw his plane. He saw him fly over the base. And I said, well, what's unusual about that to myself? And I found out that he was supposed to be hunting in Georgia and had been laid up with a cold in one of those cottages, they call them, we call them mansions. And he'd been was actually gone for some 30 hours. And this guy happened to see his plane and talk to people who did see him.
And also, I wanted to mention, too, for the first time on our program, we have audio clips of interviews that you have done with different people concerning this subject.
Yeah, we have three of them to share with you today. Let me give you a little bit about Kurtwood's background. This is his real name. He lives in Kansas City, Missouri. and he graduated from Montebello High School in California. Now, he's the guy who sent me the letter that got me turned on to this whole thing. And he joined the Air Force in 52. And he after training at Parks Air Force Base, if any of your Air Force people out there remember that as a training station, he specialized in high-altitude aerial medicine. And he was a high-altitude chamber specialist trained at Gunther Air Force Base in Alabama. Now, there aren't too many of those high-altitude chambers around, but there was one at Holloman, and he was sent out there to work with their medical team out there. And then while he was there a couple of years, about 18 months or so, and then went with the Air Sea Rescue Unit out of Yokosuka, Japan, before leaving the Air Force about 1956 or so. And this guy worked for North American Aviation, Burbank, California, Collins Radio, Newport Beach, California, Motorola, Lockheed Missile Space in Houston, Texas, and he worked for NASA, contracted with NASA to work on the training simulators for the Apollo program. And so he's really been around quite a bit. And he went to work eventually for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and he worked in database material and all together with his military service, he had 29 years of government service. Quite a distinguished record.
I was thinking that maybe we could go like a chronological order so we could kind of set the scene, you know, so people can understand, you know, what was going on at the time. You know, at the time there was a leadership change in Russia and
oh, yes, we're having a Stalin died in 1953, and he appointed his heir's successor was one of the Russian intellectuals named Malenkov. Well, make a long story short, Malenkov's five-year plan fizzled at the end of 2 years, and he was being replaced and was more or less forced to resign. And this was in February, I think, the first week of February 1955. And at the same time, the Red Chinese were getting ready to invade Formosa. Now, we know it today as Taiwan, but in those days it was pretty well known as Formosa. And they were shelling some of the offshore islands just off the mainland of China that they had, of course, taken a few years earlier in 1949 and 50 during the takeover of China. And they were pretty well sure that they were going to be invading Formosa because it's Chinese territory. They were going to take it all. Well, President Eisenhower, who had been elected, I guess, in 52, when Truman didn't run again, had warned the Red Chinese with his Secretary of State, that those days was John Foster Dulles, a very famous man, that we would use nuclear weapons to defend Taiwan, or Formosa, as the case may be, if they were invaded. Well, we're not necessarily talking about H-bombs here, but we're talking about some sophisticated nuclear warheads we had on artillery shells and things like that. And so I guess the whole world thought we were getting ready to go into World War III, and they sent about 30 people to Washington to be in Washington to pick up the news of this impending invasion of Taiwan. And there was all the international press was there, the magazines had special correspondents, about 30 of them in all. So the world was coming to the end in a handbasket, so to speak, and Eisenhower announces on the 9th of February that he's going hunting. And everybody's hunting, you know. They're ready to push the button over there, and if he's getting out of Washington, maybe we ought to get out too. I read that comment one day, looking back at the magazine and so forth. And so he calmly gets on a plane with five or six people, and Air Force One, which in those days was called the Columbine, named for the state flower of Colorado, and the next day, and they proceed to go down towards Thomasville, Georgia, and just 25 miles north of there is an air base called Spence Air Base. And they had a runway large enough to accommodate the Air Force One. And in those days, it was four-engine Lockheed. A lot of your listeners, your older listeners, will remember the Lockheed as having the big triple tail. And TWA made it real famous, flying it around the world before jets came in about 61 or 2. And so that was the president's plane, the biggest, best plane they could get, the props that those prop plane in those days. And so he proceeds on down to, they have a motorcade, and they proceed on down to the Thomasville area, which is quite a historical place. And there are some plantations there that were bought, of course, once the slavery ended after the Civil War, the plantation could no longer afford to operate as it had before. So the land kind of languished for years, and during the Depression in the 20s, some people who had some money bought the land up. Well, one of the guys that bought a big plantation down there called Milestone, I believe, was Secretary of the Treasury that Eisenhower had appointed, named Humphreys. And he had invited him down to do bird hunting, which I think the season opens down there around the 1st of February. And he'd gone down the year before and had gotten his limit every time he went out to hunt. And so that's for a hunter, that's a pretty good incentive to go back to the same place. Well, they pulled into Thomasville, and they made arrangements for the press to stay at a place called the Scott's Hotel. And it had, I think, one little bar, about five stools and a couple of tables, and a bunch of board reporters, because they couldn't go out to the plantation where Eisenhower was, which is, turns out to be a pretty good thing. And but Eisenhower and some of the guys went hunting the first night they got there on the 10th of February, 1955. They bagged a couple birds, and it started to drizzle. Well, most of your people who are hunters, who are bird hunters, will know that well, you have wet grass. You don't get the hunting dogs don't get the scent of the birds that they need. And they went out the next morning, and it was frozen, and weren't able to get a bird. Well, allegedly, I came back to the cottage, which was sort of about a 10-foot mansion of that plantation, and had the sniffles. So Press Secretary Haggard said that Ike would be inside for a few days and be playing Scrabble and drinking hot toddy with Mamie and her mother by the fireside. They'd taken down four or five people who were going to hunt with him, he'd be inside for a few days. Well, I left the press with nothing to do for two or three days, and they were kind of cooler hills over in town a few miles away. And
well, and then didn't Humphreys throw a dinner party for the press that night?
Well, actually, it was the night he came back in. And,
oh, okay.
We'll, if you don't mind, we'll hit that a little bit later.
Okay.
Well, anyhow, Eisenhower goes into seclusion, so to speak. And now we pick up the story from two Air Force One people that I managed to get the story out of. If anybody is inclined to look at to scroll down on that site, the www.ufocrashbook.com, they'll see the Air Force One crew there standing in front of the Columbine. There's a crew of 14 people. Well, eight of those people were guards, and they only took four with them on domestic trips, and then four stayed back at Andrews, where the plane was headquartered. So one of those guards was named Leo Borrego, and he told a friend of mine that had, by the way, passed away recently up north of here, that they were setting up their routine, guarding the plane, and they got word the president would be leaving in an hour, and that was at 4 a.m. At 3 a.m. And they took with them 13 Secret Service agents. They normally only take four or five. So apparently they left a whole lot of Secret Service agents at the plantation pretending that Ike was there, driving in and out and bustling around. They took four or five with them on the plane. That's why they had double agents. Apparently they're so short of agents that they could trust, they even took supervisors. The Secret Service White House supervisor was there, couple of supervisors who had been Secret Service agents were along also. And one of the Secret Service agents was proficient in seven languages. They took him along too. And I don't know whether they used him or not, but they had him along. So apparently Ike's plane leaves at 4 a.m. Ike had apparently driven back quietly up the back road to the airbase, 25 miles north, got on his plane, and they left about 4 in the morning. And now we've got to remember that we had daylight savings time in 1955, so a five-hour flight puts Eisenhower over Holloman Air Force in southern New Mexico, 1,300 miles away, about 8:30 in the morning. And that's where our story starts. And they apparently had knew he was coming because they had asked some of the airmen to stand parade, which, by the way, is red carpet treatment for a VIP. And then at the last minute, they said, well, the parade has been canceled, but he's coming anyhow. So we have our airman, who, by the way, is working as an orderly at the base hospital. And he's talking to his supervisor is a man named Dorsey. And so we're going to pick up in a few seconds. We want to get Dorsey queued up. Dorsey is his supervisor, and they were looking for Dorsey. Dorsey came in and said he'd seen what they called a silver disc, a flying saucer hovering over part of the base. And they had been to a meeting several days before, the supervisors of the base, saying, Eisenhower's going to be here, business as usual, don't anyone gawk or anything like that. So our first tape is Airman Kirtland as he reported to work, and they're talking about Dorsey and when he finally came in. It's quite interesting.
Okay, Joe, if you would play that first clip, please.
So when I went to normal work the next morning, at about 8 o'clock, I walked into the flight surgeon's office, and I was asked by the nurse if I had seen Dorsey. And Dorothea Thorensen, who worked there, said, I saw him. She says, and he was going to the commissary with his wife. So I didn't think anything more of it, and I just went on. Dorothea was a clerk typist in the flight surgeon's
office.
Yes, a civilian. She was married, and she had a very nice car. I remember it was Oldsmobile Holiday. when she said that he had come in later, I didn't think anything of it. When I went to coffee that day, but before I went to coffee, I saw Dorsey coming down the hall. He was an airman who was in charge of the men, the other airmen, at the flight surgeon's office. And he said, Bill, have you seen what's out there on the flight line? And I'm thinking, no, I haven't seen anything. He says, you should go and see it. I said, what is it? He said, it's a disc. When he said disc, I'm thinking a disc like we threw at college, about this big, with a silver or stainless steel rim, wood, and
the track discus. They use the track.
Discus. Yeah. That's what I expected. He says, no. I said, what's it made out of? He said, metal. And I said, oh, what's its color? He says, silvery, you know, stainless polished steel, stainless steel or silver. And I said, well, how big is it? I'm still thinking 12 inches or less. He said, 20 to 30 feet. I said, what's it doing? He says, hovering in the air. The only craft that I knew could hover was the hovercraft that the Navy was talking about building, flying pancake or flying flapjack, the hovercraft that would come in on off the shore, and a helicopter. And this wasn't any of those. So I said, well, I'll go and see it. He says, it's out in front. Just go to the front of the hospital and take a look. So to do that, I had to ask permission. And I went up to the where an officer was being examined and knocked on the door, and the nurse came to it and said, I said, can I go to the front of the hospital and look down flight way? And she looked at the doctor, and she said, no. So I didn't go. And I went on coffee break.
Hang on
a second. We've got to wait for a second till we, so they can hear us. Okay, now they can hear us.
Okay, I went on a was interested in this story because he's kind of confined to this building, and he'd asked the his doctor supervisor if he could go out and look at the UFO. In those days they didn't call them UFOs, and this was just a disc, you know, to them. And they said no. Well, this reflects that information I got from one of the supervisors that they were just business as usual, no gawking or anything. So they were trying very hard to follow those rules and of not gawking around there. And so he had originally said that he was didn't want to go stand parade, with the president coming into the airplane. And then they had canceled it, so he said, well, I'll work that day. Well, he said, it was the biggest mistake of my life. If I hadn't worked that day, I would have been able to see the president, his airplane, and everything else. He did see the plane later. But, this was Airman Kirtland getting a report from his supervisor that a big disc was hanging over the flight line. Now, there's two of them. Wait to hear where the second one was. I think we probably ought to roll that second segment. It goes about 3 minutes, and he's talking about going to a coffee break. Apparently, every 10 o'clock or so in the morning, they go out for coffee break. And this people that he overhears talking are talking about Eisenhower landing and his Eisenhower walking towards the UFO and going aboard it.
Joe, if you'd play that second clip, please.
When I went on coffee break about 9:30, I came back from coffee, and I was following two pilots. The one on the right was wearing blues, and the one on the left was wearing khakis. Now, at Holloman, during winter, normal work procedures, unless you were assigned official duties, was khakis. If you were assigned a job like officer of the day or something like that, or meeting somebody formally, you would wear blues. The man on the right was wearing blues. He was a second lieutenant. The one on the left was wearing khakis. Now, the one on the left was wearing khakis, and I heard them talking back and forth, and one of them said, did you see Air Force One? I didn't know what Air Force One was. I had to ask later what it was, what it meant. And he says, yeah. He says, Big Bird, isn't it? He says, yes. And when he was talking about that, he said, well, what happened? The one on the right said, "I'm the officer of the day." He said, "What happened is they landed on the runway." He says, "And turned around and stayed on the active."
What does the word active mean?
Well, it means that's the runway that they're using to land and take off airplanes
from. And no other planes are allowed on?
No, not there. Not at that time. So, he turned around on the active. He said, "We were told to turn off our radar." Well, after we shut off the radar, he says, they came over the mountains, over the White Sands Proving Ground and the monument. He says, "I heard," and the one on the left said, "I heard one landed at the monument."
Can you explain the monument?
The monument is White Sands Monument, and it's down the road from Holloman Air Force Base to the west.
It's an area, specific area?
It's a public park monument. And what he was saying was he had heard that one of them landed there. And the one on the right said, "I don't know whether that was true or not." He says, "I'm telling you what I saw. What I saw is one came overhead, two of them came in over. One landed on the runway in front of him," he says, "and the other one hovered overhead 200, 300 feet. He said, "And what happened?" He said, "Well, he got out of the airplane and walked down, and he couldn't see the door opening on this craft because he didn't have binoculars." And then he said, "Well, what happened?" And he said, "He went aboard the craft for 40 or 45 minutes. And
now, who was he?
The person who got out of Air Force One. It was his plane. So it had to be Eisenhower. Now, I didn't see this, but it just had to be Eisenhower. And Eisenhower is a very brave man, and he would have no problems going aboard a foreign UFO, if that's what it was, for 40 or 45 minutes.
I have a question here, Bill. Was there a gangway or something out that area?
So they probably had a ladder structure of some
kind. At least as high as a basketball goal.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So he came down and went aboard, walked to the craft and went aboard. He says, "Well, then what happened?" He says, "Well, when he got out, shook hands, and he walked off." And he went out of the airplane and walked back to his... He went out of their craft and walked back to his own airplane. I went to work, and after work, I was called out of my room in the barracks and ran out in the back, and Air Force One was flying overhead. Anyway, it flew over the residential area, and no airplane was allowed to turn and fly over the residential Air Force, the residential area of the Air Force base there, because it wasn't safe. If they crashed, it would crash into these residents. So the only one that got a...
Oh, they're talking here about...
Okay, hang on.
Yeah.
Hang on a moment.
All right. Let me know when you're ready.
Okay, there we go.
They're talking here about the guy who's your military people will recognize as the officer of the day, wearing a different colored uniform, usually a dress uniform, going to the main tower. At Holloman, the runways were two runways. One was long and a short one. There, in the middle, there was a bar, kind of like an H, and a bar of an A, rather. And the tower was situated there. Well, they had apparently stopped the Air Force One as far out on the other runway as possible. My guess is it would be somewhere around a half to three-quarters of a mile. And so those in the tower who had binoculars could see what was going on. But apparently the craft that came down in front, this is a UFO now, came down in front of the Air Force One, we think maybe 100 to 200 feet away, had the door facing away from the base, so people at the tower couldn't see whether it was deliberate or I don't know, but that didn't make a difference. They could see that this gentleman walking up towards the UFO had the same gait as the president, and they were pretty sure that it was the president. He went inside, shook hands with somebody in the doorway, went inside for 40, 45 minutes. And this is what the airman said he heard at from the coffee hour, and these two guys were talking. So this is not to be confused with some of your people who read about UFOs that Eisenhower visited Edwards Air Force Base. This was the year before. We don't know about that. I don't have data on that. I do know that he was supposed to have at least seen some bodies and maybe a crashed craft or two at Edwards Air Force Base in 1954. By the way, it was also February 54, so it seems like that's the time to get out of Washington. And this is a totally new event that we have, that Airman Kirtland told us about happened in 1955. Now,
when did you get this letter from Kirkland that first alerted you to
this?
Oh,
I think about 2004, about 3-4 years ago. And I've been speaking about this on several UFO talks, and have presented it at one UFO talk, and we have Kirkland on saying all these things that you heard. Audio on, also on video. We actually took this from a video. So once in a while he'll mention something that, you know, is a video term, like, see, it was about this size or this big around or what have you. So this is taken from a video that I made of retired Airman Kirtland at the Eisenhower Library in Abilene, Kansas, in the summer of 2006. We're sitting at the Eisenhower Library making this tape.
And also I'd like to let everybody know, in case you guys go start trying to find information on an Airman Kirkland, this is not his real name. It's a pseudonym to protect
him. It is a pseudonym, but it's very close to his real name. He does is a kind of a private person. And he is a very, very real person. And he's come forward with a very astounding material. And you know how sometimes in the UFO field we have people that could believe anything. Well, most of them don't believe. Think this is a pretty tall stretch. But we also have two other witnesses we'll bring up just a little bit later. Now, we may have already gone over this, but it might be a good time for us to hit it again. This is called the flyover. And it's about 33 seconds, talking about going outside the barracks. So I want the listeners to realize that he did get off work around 4 or 4:30. And he saw Eisenhower's plane. There was only one plane like it. It was the only Lockheed plane of the day that had a black nose, which, by the way, was a radar. Weather radar thing that was fairly new in 1955, and there were Nixon, by the way, Vice President Nixon, was in South America, and he had another plane assigned to him. So there's only one plane like this one, Eisenhower's, and this is what he saw. So if you could ready to run that, he's talking about sometime about 4:45 in the afternoon. It goes about 30 seconds or so.
Okay, Joe, if you would play that third clip, please.
I went to work, and after work, I was called out of my room in the barracks and ran out in the back, and Air Force One was flying overhead. Anyway, it flew over the residential area, and no airplane was allowed to turn and fly over the residential Air Force, the residential area of the Air Force base there, because it wasn't safe. If they crashed, it would crash into these residents. So the only one that got... The
plane took out right over the housing tract at the air base. And I imagine that the pilot didn't do it deliberately, but that's the way it worked out. And he happened to remember that quite a bit. So we have the plane leaving about 5:30 in the afternoon. Now, if they arrived there at 9:30 in the morning, The question is, what was Eisenhower doing for 5 or 6 hours at Holloman if his meeting was over in 45 minutes? Well, apparently, with the base commander, they made 3 talks, not about UFOs or anything like this. They made 3 talks, kind of patriotic talks. You guys are doing a good job here. By the way, there's about 5,000 airmen there, Air Force personnel, and I believe about 8,000 or 9,000 civilians working at the base on various projects. And most of them lived in nearby Alamogordo. And that's where Airman Dorsey, by the way, was living. And that's why he came in a little bit late to his the base hospital. So apparently they went around and they made several talks. And we have located a witness who will be one of our last witnesses. Who heard saw the plane land and Eisenhower and heard Eisenhower talk. There is a real strong witness there, somebody who's seen saw it both. So it took us 3 or 4 years to get to dig all this material out. After I got his letter, then I had to verify it. We sent for his military record, and everything he said is absolutely true. At least from the standpoint of where he was at the time and where he was assigned and what he was doing and so forth and so on. And this man is very, very credible in my book.
You were lucky to find this guy or him find you.
I was. I'm not sure what his luck or not. I mean, he already retired. Somebody hit you with something like this. I couldn't retire until I got it at least investigated. And then we put together all that material about Eisenhower on his hunting trip from the public record. It's the only time he could have possibly gone on this trip was the 30 hours he was missing when he was supposed to be, had gotten the sniffles hunting birds. And he's apparently, then he goes back, by the way, to Thomasville, and a day later comes out and says, well, you guys, sorry I kind of was laid up, but he has a few photo op or two, and then goes back and doesn't come out until the next day. So he was gone, something like, I think, about 33 hours, so totally. Our next segment, we could talk about it. Dr. Reiner was a good friend of the major. Dr. Reiner was a good friend of our Airman Kirtland's. And they were close together. And so he had one of the jobs that the airman had was to clean up, not clean up, but make sure the building was secure at night. And he noticed from wherever he happened to be at his barracks area somewhere that there was a light on over at the hospital area, and he went over to check it out. And we'll be coming up here to what we call Kirtland Reiner 04, segment 04. Mm-hmm. And get ready here in a few minutes. And he went over there, and there was a colonel in there talking with Dr. Reiner. They're talking about Eisenhower speaking around the base that day, and some of the things that were said, and the fact that they had to have more than one talk, and they were kind of crowded, and we have to understand here that the Air Force personnel in the mid-50s didn't know any more than the civilians did about UFOs. Now, that doesn't mean that some of them might have known about Roswell, because they separated those Roswell guys out real quick, shipped them all over the world so they couldn't compare notes. And a lot of those Roswell people who helped pick up that wreckage weren't there a year later at Roswell. So they kept things pretty quiet by keeping the Air Force personnel as far away as possible and not having them just sit around and talk about it. So they didn't know what a UFO was. They had heard of flying saucers like everybody else had, but they were pretty well laughed off. I was just barely getting into it in 1955, and I remember seeing some pictures of the newspaper where somebody said, well, somebody just threw a garbage can lid up and photographed it, and here's a saw, and oh, yes, there's this weather balloon. We get those mixed up with UFOs. And so a lot of us weren't terribly sharp in those days. Now, Harbin was a super secret base, and they had all kinds of secret materials going on, the things going on there. As a matter of fact, they had the precursor to the space program there. And one of the gentlemen there, his name was Stapp, had gone 600 miles an hour in a sled on rails to see if the human body could take that kind of G-forces. And that had just happened in December, prior to the February of 55. That happened, I think, around the 10th of December, 1954. And this guy had his picture on Time Magazine and everything. And so the people at the base knew that the German paperclip guys, which were the scientists in Operation Paperclip, were nearby at the White Sands Missile Range and were working on German V-2 rockets. There were some of those people were there. I'm not sure whether von Braun was there or not, but there was a big contingency there. So they were more or less conditioned and not discouraged from believing that some of the secret materials that they would be seeing had come from the Germans. So some of them think that this UFO hovering over the flight line, like Dorsey reported earlier, was probably something that the Germans had made. They had a very high regard for the German scientists, but I don't think anyone discouraged that idea that this was something that the Germans had made, because we know now it's probably extraterrestrial. And so I think possibly at this time we might go into the number four Kirtland Reiner segment. It goes about a minute and a half or so.
Okay, and Joe, if you would play that fourth clip, please.
That night after supper, I looked at the flight surgeon's office, and one of my jobs is to check and make sure that the lights and everything was secure. There's no lights over there. So I went in the back way, and when I went into the back way, I was talking, I saw Captain Reiner talking to a lieutenant colonel who was dressed in blue. Reiner had his flight coat-like, smock-like on. They were talking, and the colonel said, I don't know about others. He says, well, I'm telling you what I saw. He says, I was standing on the stage with him. And Reiner spoke up and said, I heard that he spoke also at the base theater. He said he might have. He only spoke a couple of minutes at one place. And then the base commander took over, and he spoke for about 20 minutes. So it was plenty of time for him to go from the supply hangar to the base, to the base theater and back again. He said, I'm telling you what I saw. Standing room only in the supply hangar, 225 men each time. He said, there might have been a third time. He said, but I wasn't there. And I said, who spoke? And the lieutenant colonel said, commander-in-chief. And I said, the president. And he said, the commander-in-chief, he repeated himself. Well, I know, and you know, that the commander-in-chief is.
Oh, he's talking here about this colonel talking to Dr. Reiner, that Eisenhower had given several presentations with the base commander that day. And he, by the way, there were no inspections. He wasn't looking at anybody. Wasn't looking at any departments. He didn't go out and visit. They just went around and they talked to some guys, and it seemed to me like a very interesting use of the president's time in the middle of an international emergency to go out to Holloman Air Force Base and say, you guys are doing a good job, keep up the good work, which is essentially what he said at the presentations. And so we have information that from through Airman Kirtland that and his boss Dr. Reiner that they was several presentations given sometime in the afternoon of We think it's February 12th, 1955. We think this was the day he visited there. It wasn't very close. Well, this brings up the most fascinating witness we have. This lady wrote to UFO Magazine. We had an article in UFO Magazine about 2004, I believe it was, February, dealing with, I think they called it Ike-like subterfuge. And I had written the article, and they put it in there about this project. And she had seen, her friend had seen an article, this article, and remembered that this lady said that her husband, her father, had been assigned as a civilian electrician to Holloman Air Force Base in 1955 or somewhere in the mid-50s. And what's our break time look like, Dee, here?
We've got about 9 minutes till we
okay.
go to break.
This is a 5 minutes, 31 seconds. Oh, I think we probably go ahead and squeeze it in before the break, if that's okay.
Sure.
Yeah. And so I went back to Auburn, Nebraska to meet this lady, and she had a little difficulty with her family. She was going through a divorce, and there was she didn't want to be known, didn't want to know where she was, so to speak. So she wouldn't let me have a copy of the letter, but she did agree to read it on videotape. And so what we hear here is a letter from her father, who was an electrician, the day Eisenhower came to Holloman Air Force Base in 1955. And this is the number five in our series. We call it The Electrician's Daughter. And he apparently had been telling this story at family reunions for years. And they finally said, Dad, why don't you write this down, you know? And I said, well, okay, all right, the way it worked out. So the mother had been writing the letter home, and she then says, Dad's here, and he'll tell his story again. And there, as soon as we get it patched in there, this is the letter that the daughter is reading from her mother and father, mentioning this incident and how he became nicknamed the fireman.
Okay, Joe, if you would play clip number five for us, please.
Letter's right here. I'm sure I'll find that one. Yeah, here's the one that Mom and Dad wrote. Okay, that's Auburn, Nebraska, October 26, 1989. Dear kids, it's beautiful fall here with the usual pumpkins up and down the main drag. Kids are getting excited. Your father and I are doing well. Heard from Helen. She said the grandchild came on time, and although Sharon was in labor, well, you don't need to talk about that. Dad has just come from the kitchen with a cup of coffee, and he says he doesn't mind telling the fireman's story again, but you kids know it better after all these years. But he'll recall what he can. All right, this is the part. Well, you kids and Mom moved down from Albuquerque, I think it was in the summer of 1954. As you recall, I had taken the Hollerman job that previous winter, and Mom wanted us all together, so we rented a place over near Dudley Elementary School. On Maryland, wasn't it? Remember, you kids could walk to school. You were in the fourth grade, and Billy was in first or second. Anyhow, sometime after Christmas of 55, we were told President Eisenhower was coming. So George, our boss then at the electric shop, went to a meeting to find out more. He would not be inspecting anything, and they said, just carry on as usual. If you see the president, don't gawk, wave, or anything. Just carry on. So the day the president came, we went out in the truck to a job where we were replacing some wire down the flight line. It was really old stuff, but it put there in World War II, and safe. So we heard the president's plane in the morning lining up for an approach and watched it land on the far runway. So we waited for it to taxi over to the flight line so we could see him. But we didn't hear it anymore, and It had shut down somewhere out there. So we went ahead and pulled wire for a while, and one of the men, I believe it was Charlie, said he can see out there from that pole over there. So why don't one of us go up the pole and see where the plane is? Well, I had my climbers on, and I started to unbuckle them and was waiting to give them to the first volunteer. When someone said I should do it, as people were used to seeing me up on the poles anyway. So I started up with my back to the sun, a safety measure, which also put my back to the runway where we thought his Connie was. Connie was a nickname for the big constellation the president flew. As I started up, some of the guys reminded me not to gawk, and I heard them laugh. A few minutes later, I heard some shouting, and some guys tarring a hangar roof nearby started to run, pointing out to the runway. Then I heard our truck start up, and some of the crew jumped in with one or two running after it. And they're pointing out to the flight line, and so I decided to turn around on the pole to see what the ruckus was about, and I could not believe what I saw. There was this pie tin-like thing coming at me about 150 feet away. I thought it was remote controlled or something, 25 to 30 feet across, and I started down the pole as fast as I could go. I was up about 40 feet, and I threw my climbing rope out, gave it slack, and only touched the spike on each side of the pole three or four times on each side in before I got to the bottom. While I was running towards the big hangar, I looked back, and it had stopped and was just sitting there. Well, when we all got back to the shop and we had a good lap, one of the guys who saw me come down said he got down that pole faster than a fireman. So as you kids were growing up and we had the family gatherings, you used to ask to tell me about the time I became a fireman. You know, I always wondered why we did not use that thing during Vietnam and so forth. And over the years, I realized if we had technology like that, it would have saved lots of lives. But I gradually realized that it had something to do with Ike being there that day. And it wasn't ours. It was an unwritten rule at Holloman. You didn't talk about what you saw. And after that day, it was seldom mentioned at the shop. I still have those climbers here someplace. Billy used to play with them. Remember? Mom here again. Well, Dad's wandered outside someplace. He said something about checking the pump. It's been sluggish lately. Dad thinks the motor's old and needs rewinding. He spends several hours a week up at Harold's helping out with mechanical and electrical stuff for farm equipment. Dr. Fornash says it's okay for Dad to drive a little around town, but to keep an eye on him. He thinks Dad has had a mini stroke or two, but should not do any highway driving at night. He drags his left foot a little, but gets out to the golf course in good weather, but he has to use a cart now. We're looking forward to seeing all of you at Christmas. Say hi to Bob and Warren for us and hug the twins. All of our love, Mom and Dad.
The poignant...
Oh, just a second.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay, there we go.
The poignant part of this letter was, it was his last one. He died of a massive stroke just shortly after Christmas. That letter was written about Thanksgiving. And he had never written about this, and they finally got to his last letter. So you see why she didn't want to share it with me. And she left out the various private parts of the letter. And it's an incredible letter. And she was quite taken after reading it and cried a little after we finished it.
Oh, that's understandable. And good timing, too, because it's time for us to go to a break. So we'll be back here in about 8 minutes here on Eye to the Sky, the UFO synopsis, here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. And welcome back to Eyes of the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, here on UFO Paranormal Radio Network, also broadcast live on UPRN 105.3 New Orleans. I'm your host, DeAndrew, and tonight we've been talking with Art Campbell. I've been talking about Eisenhower's, I guess you could call it a semi-clandestine trip to Holloman Air Force Base on February 11th, 1955, to possibly meet with extraterrestrials, and it's been an interesting story. And Art, we still have one more audio clip to go into. If you'd like to set that one up before we get to it.
Okay, well, let me tell you about this gentleman. I got a phone call from his brother, who was not living not far from me. He said that he had a brother that had been with President Eisenhower had seen him at an air base. And I said, "Would you happen to know what air base?" He said, "Well, we think it's one of those in New Mexico. We're not sure." But he had seen him speak there. And so this is a pseudonym also, Dave Wyckoff. He's a staff sergeant. He's an extraordinary man. He joined the U.S. Army Air Force in 1943 as a teenager and was trained as a B-29 tail gunner. Wyckoff flew 43 missions over Japan. He has a Bronze Star, two Purple Hearts, plus a lot of other medals. And we did our interview in Oakland, California. And he returned there, the Bay Area, after he left the military in World War II. He was called back in the Air Force, like a lot of guys were in those days, in 1951, during the Korean War. And they assigned him because he had expertise and a little bit of rank as a loadmaster, which is the person that loads the planes up, makes sure the loads are balanced and the cargo's strapped down and everything like that. And he was not sent to Korea, but he was delivering cargo all over the United States from Bacaval Air Force Base in Indiana. And he said in February of 55, and I said, "How do you know it's 55? He said, "Well, that was my last trip. That was when I got out of the Air Force after the Korean War." He went to Holloman with some cargo, and in the morning that he and his crew were to leave on the 12th, they went down to their plane, which was supposed to be serviced and was waiting for them, and the plane wasn't there, and they were told at the ops office that their plane wouldn't be there that day because the president was coming and all traffic was closed. The base traffic was closed. And the guy says, "As a matter of fact, there's a whole bunch of people out there lined up along a fence." And he said, "That's the president's plane's coming in now. He's making a final approach." And they said that you'll be grounded here until he leaves. Well, we know from previous testimony that he's there. He was there for almost 5 or 6 hours. And so this guy kind of argues with the fellow there, says, "Well, we got you home. We got it all cleared with your pilot and so forth. Just go back, kick back at the enlisted man's barracks where they'd stayed, play pool, whatever you want to do." But anyhow, they were in a mess hall about chow hall about noon, apparently at 12:30 or 1 o'clock, and a major came up to their table. Now, there's about five of them here from who had come in from Indiana with Wyckoff, and said, "Do you want to hear the president speak?" And a couple of them, I guess, didn't think it was such a great idea, and they were planning to go into Alamogordo. They had some dress clothes with them, which allowed them to get off the base, and the other guys were wearing fatigues and didn't bring any with them. And Wyckoff and another guy said, "Well, sure, we'd like to go down." So they went down to a hangar, and apparently this must be the supply hangar that Kirkland talked about earlier. And there was very tight security. Well, they didn't have a Holloman a badge on. They were visitors from another Air Force base, and they didn't have so they couldn't get in. Well, one of the officers there noted their plight and said, "We think he's going to be speaking again down at the base theater." And do you want to hear him there? Yeah, we'll go and listen to him. Sure. So they finally got him in to hear what the president said. And the incredible thing here was that I was trying to make sure that the guy wasn't pulling my leg or something, and he said it had to have been the date of February 11th and so forth. And I said, well, how do you know that it was that date? How do you remember that well? He said, it's right here on my discharge. And he had a date on his discharge of February 22nd, 1955. He said that was about a week before I was discharged. That's how I remember it. And I thought, wow. Talk about collaboration here. So let's put Wyckoff up. And he's talking here about the coming into Holloman with some freight.
Okay, Joe, if you would play that last clip for us, clip number 6.
While I was out in Indiana, my job was loading and delivering a cargo. We went to Washington, where they opened a new base with cargo, and just kind of anything they wanted, we would fly it.
What other bases did you go to?
Well, I went to March and Holloman two or three times. We hauled what we think is stuff for the atomic bomb.
Dave, what do you recall about Holloman?
Well, we had a haul a load of stuff down there, parts that they needed. And the runway is like this, and I never seen anything like that before. And anyway, as we were there, we saw Air Force One come in, and we didn't know who it was. And then we come, an officer come around and says, "You can't leave." And I says, "Well, the pilot said we have to leave." And he says, "Well, President Eisenhower's here, and you can't leave the field until he's gone." And I says, "You can hear him over loudspeakers, but it didn't do any good, you know. I would have liked to have seen him." And this officer, we didn't have the clearance to go into the mess hall. And one of the other officers, a higher ranking officer, came to us and says, "Would you like to go in and eat and listen to a speech?" And most of us said, "Yeah, because I'd like to see him." I didn't get to shake his hand or anything, but because I didn't have the right badge, clearance, to go in, but they did leave us go in at the very end, and we ate and listened to his speech.
What did you think of him?
I thought he was great. He had a lot of good ideas. Maybe he had some I disagreed with, but I don't agree with everybody anyway, you know.
Well, Dave, do you remember what date that was that you were there?
The reason I know him, when he was there, and here's what I got discharged, he was there in mid-February of 1955. That was my last trip that I made while I was in the service. Then I was discharged, and I came back home to the Bay Area with my family.
Okay, there we go.
Well, there we have the perfect witness. He saw Ike land and heard him speak. And apparently he couldn't leave before the president did. And, of course, by the time at 5:30 in the evening, it was a little late to fly back to Indiana because it would have been a night flight. It's probably, probably 5 or 6 hour flight at least. So apparently they left the next day back to their base. And they were all excited that they got to hear the president speak. And, of course, there was nothing said about a UFO and to him. They were there on the base, but we were in a base of almost 15,000 people, and you're going to find something. Some people are going to see something, and some people are not going to see anything. We know our electrician did. We know that Staff Sergeant Wyckoff stole the plane land. We know he heard Eisenhower speak. And we know that from the conversation at the hospital office that Dr. Reiner's friend, that I spoke several times. And this sort of brought up a real mystery for me, Dee. I thought, well, what in the world? The world paused, at least as close as we'd come to nuclear war up to 1955. Russians were looking for a new leader, and they were kind of edgy. The European people were kind of didn't want to go back into a war footing that, you know, they'd been in 10 years earlier, and things are popping loose in Formosa and so forth, and the president goes hunting, and it didn't seem to fit. Then to have him out here just talking with the base commander at several different venues makes it look to me like that it was killing time. And surely they had better things to do after going aboard a UFO in the morning than talking to a bunch of people at the flight hangar.
Could he just possibly have been doing that to give like a cover story as being a reason why he was there, just to people there on the base?
Well, interesting enough, it was top secret that he left. Georgia, but he spoke to at least 400 people that we know of at the base. And so his presence at the base wasn't a secret. So the people in Georgia didn't know that he had come from Georgia. So we didn't have the TV news, and the people weren't following the president that close in those days, you know. Didn't have the communication set up. So whatever went on back east, you know, big news certainly came out over the television and so forth, but many of us in the Midwest didn't get television set until 53 or 4. So that famous football game between the Giants and Baltimore was until 2 years later. So the people in the East did not know that Eisenhower was in the West. But while he was there, he didn't mind showing himself. Well, we put together a theory, which is rather interesting. One of the articles we found, and if your readers want to scroll on the Eisenhower article, the UFO Crash Book, .com, Eisenhower articles, they'll see some photographs we have there of the, not photographs, but reenactment photographs of the UFO and the Air Force One and some other things, including Ike and Mamie. And anyhow, you'll see a picture there of a fellow named Haggerty, who was the press secretary, who was with Eisenhower. And I'm sorry, he was not with Eisenhower. He was left in Georgia. And he announced to the press on the morning of about noon of the morning of the 12th, that's about 3 hours difference now from where Eisenhower is, that there'd be a party thrown at the country club that night. And the big country club there is called the Glen Everon Country Club, and Ike played golf there in good weather, and had come down there and done quite a bit of, had vacationing in the area. So they took all of the international press, and we think there were 30 of them, at least one of the articles said 30 of them, Time Magazine, Warner Path News, and then several newspapers from overseas. And then, to make sure that they covered the press thoroughly, they invited all of the local radio and newspaper press to meet to the dinner at the country club and free drinks. Well, this would be an interesting situation where the president was laid up with a cold and couldn't be out for a couple of days, and so here we have a party thrown. Well, naturally, everybody's going to go. It's a small town. And I think they threw that party to get everybody soused up, so to speak, so Eisenhower could slip in later that night in his airplane, and there wouldn't be anybody going up to see him arriving. And I think by the time at 9:30 or 10 o'clock, 10:30, 11 came along, Eisenhower by that time had been flying 5 hours from Holloman and had made up the daylight savings time, and probably got in there about the time that everybody went to bed. And next morning, Eisenhower had a press conference, and somebody mentioned in one of the newspaper articles that he looked a little haggard for a man who had been resting for 3 days. And I imagine that the newsmen themselves didn't look too good after having had Bloody Marys for breakfast trying to cure all those hangovers. So it was a very interesting thing. And I think they were kind of stalling for time so that the daylight savings time would slip in. Eisenhower could get back, and it wouldn't be noticed that he was gone. And he came out the next day, and they had a photo op, and then the next day he came out again and had lunch at another plantation and left for Washington, D.C. back on the 13th. Incredible 4 days.
The people that were with him on this, I guess just on the trip to Georgia, I don't know whether they would be with him when he went to Holloman, but the people that were with him on this trip is an interesting collection of people.
Oh goodness! The Eisenhower Library sent me the entire flight crew list. That's how we know which ones of the flight crew were on duty, and all of the passengers. And there were six passengers in Ike's social party, the hunting party. There was Mrs. Eisenhower and her mother, Mrs. Dowd. And they have both been Denver, Colorado socialites in their day. And a couple of men, I can't think of names right now, who hunted with Ike. And then there were 13 Secret Service agents. And one of the Air Force One guys told me, he said, we never took 13 agents. There was no reason to. Well, there was in this case because they had to maintain the presence of Eisenhower in Georgia when he was actually out in New Mexico. So having somebody driving the vehicles in and out of the gate of the plantation, by the way, the reporters weren't allowed to go inside this gate of the plantation, and keeping things, the traffic pattern moving normally, would allay any suspicions that Eisenhower had gone anywhere. I think that's why they had the double ones. Well, I went down to the passenger list, and I was figuring all this out, feeling kind of smug, and there was a name popped up, Arthur Godfrey. Now, Arthur Godfrey wasn't in the social list of people. He wasn't sitting with even gave a seat number, so we know approximately where he was sitting. And then there was another guy by the name of John Lemon, which is not the one that we know of the Beatles, but apparently was a radio producer sitting on with him. And I thought, what in the world is Arthur Godfrey doing going from Washington to Thomasville, Georgia? And we did some research at a website. Some of your listeners may want to try it. Conelrad, C-O-N-E-L-R-A-D. And it deals with all the things that went on during the Cold War, like the bomb shelters and so forth and so on. And it mentions an article in a Time magazine, 1992, called The Doomsday Blueprint. And it talks about what we were going to do is if we had been attacked by nuclear bombs. You got to remember now, the Russians were nervous. They had just exploded the first bomb a few years before, so they had operational bombs. We were thinking about using some nuclear material against the Red Chinese if they invaded Formosa, and so people were building bomb shelters in their backyards. People weren't panicking, but some of those who had the resources were sort of doing it. And there's lots of information about civil defense, evacuation routes, and so forth. This was going on in the mid 50s, And civil defense was really high because in case we'd been attacked, they wanted to give the people some options.
Could I get you to repeat that website again? Some people didn't quite understand what you were saying.
It's a website they call ConelRad, C-O-N-E-L-R-A-D. They can just Google it. I think they'll come up with it. And it talks about all the different things that went on during the civil defense when we had a high interest in civil defense. Thought we might need it. And it talks about the facilities that were remodeled, the building underground bomb shelter under your house, what to take in with you, what not to take with you. Fascinating website. Well, on that site, we learned from this article in Time magazine, I think it's 1992, August 8th, I believe, that the government had retained Arthur Godfrey and Edward R. Murrow to make public service announcements that all was okay in case we had been attacked by nuclear weapons. I thought, my goodness, here we have the guy who's supposed to be making the announcement that we've been attacked by nuclear bombs on the President's Air Force One plane. And that was confirmed by Frank Stanton, who, by the way, passed away a couple of years ago, who's been the head of CBS for many years, that the government had actually had Edward R. Murrow, who was a well-known news personality, very calm, reassuring kind of man, and he sort of was the media person that brought down the Senator McCarthy, then the McCarthy era.
Yes,
so
if anybody had seen the movie Good Luck and Good Night,
yes, that's
about
yeah.
about that would yeah. know who you're talking about.
Yeah, it was a great film, wasn't it?
Oh, it was wonderful.
Yeah, wonderful. And so they had made arrangements to use Arthur Godfrey, by the way, who was a grandfatherly speaking kind of person, very reassuring. They said he could sell a fur coat to somebody in the South Sea Islands or a freezer or an Eskimo. This guy was a super salesman. And the government had got the one reassuring reporter and one super salesman. He had a variety show, by the way, in the mid-50s. It was a top-rated show in its day, kind of like Carol Burnett was later, those kind of things. And in any case, I think here that the government was hedging their bets. And in case we had been attacked while Eisenhower was in Georgia or on this trip, we understand they had made recordings, but we also had the actual person who had made the recording, at least one of them, Arthur Godfrey, on that plane from Washington, from Andrews Air Force Base to Spence Air Force Base with Eisenhower, who later went out to Holloman. Now, as far as I know, hardly anybody went on the Holloman leg, except maybe a dozen people, several Secret Service, several plane guards, and the plane crew. It was more or less a skeleton crew that went out to Holloman. But this opens up a whole new ball game of what was going on in the 1950s. I had just met my wife. We'd been engaged. But we were married in 58, so we just finished our 50th wedding anniversary. And I was just absolutely blown away because of what all these people were doing for us. We had no idea this was going on behind the scenes, you know. We're that close to... Now, we got again closer to nuclear war in 1960 with the Cuban Missile Crisis. But apparently this one was close for those days. And those people were on that plane, and we found out from the Secret Service, the Air Force One guys, that they never took over five except on one occasion. And when Ike went out west somewhere, they needed a double crew of Secret Service agents to maintain what they thought was his presence at that plantation when he was actually out west at Holloman Air Force Base. So this thing got really intriguing very, very quickly.
And if I remember correctly, too, wasn't the pilot of Air Force One a well-known World War II vet?
Well, actually, he had flown Eisenhower during World War II. His name was William Draper. And he later, before he retired, I think, in probably about the time Eisenhower left office. He retired, I believe, as a full colonel. And he had flown Eisenhower around. Then Eisenhower was the head of NATO for several years, based in France, and Draper had been his pilot there. So, he knew. As a matter of fact, he had Draper on his roles as an assistant, so once in a while, Draper went to meetings with him. He was officially part of Eisenhower's entourage, not only just his pilot. But I read his some interesting memoir. He said that when they were on a long flight, Eisenhower had absolutely no trouble sleeping. He had a little area kind of curtained off. He liked the old Pullman cars or something in the plane, and a room. And he'd go in there and he could really saw logs. He said a few times on long trips overseas, Eisenhower would be walking up and down the plane aisle in his pajamas and robe and slippers, and go up and talk to the flight crew, and was quite a nice guy. But he was kind of an aloof guy. These other guys that really thought the world of Truman, and they liked Ike too, but Truman was their guy. Truman had apparently, at the time of we first had Daquan came out as a fabric for clothing. Harry Truman got the idea of putting the Air Force guys in Daquan uniforms so they wouldn't need pressing; they always look sharp. So apparently, he found the money and gave every one of those 14 guys on his Air Force One, by the way, which became Eisenhower's a couple years later, when Eisenhower won the election in 52. But apparently around 51 or so, these Air Force One guys had custom uniforms but made out of a Dacron material. Of course, they're winter, kind of a surge of material. But the Air Force One guys really added a dimension to this thing. They didn't know where Ike was or what he was doing, but they were able to confirm that he'd gone west. They never took more than five or six Secret Service agents, and everything just fits in perfectly. And they were quite a bunch.
Yeah, it's amazing that, gosh, I mean, because everybody was all over the fact that Eisenhower went missing for a little while when he went to,
Edwards.
Was it Edwards? Yeah. Edwards, the year before.
Well, Ike never made the same mistake twice. He apparently had this one well planned out. Because he was incognito in a cottage, recovering from a cold, supposedly, and he was seen out in the Holloman Air Force Base the next day.
This is truly an amazing story. The airman, Kirkland, is he still alive?
Yes, he is. As a matter of fact, he and I will probably be, we have been invited tentatively to the Exopolitics Conference in Gaithersburg, Maryland, I believe the third week in April.
Awesome.
And he'll be telling his story at that time to a live audience. So he and I have done several other radio shows, but it's pretty hard to get two people to go to have their way paid to a conference, and they've got travel and what have you. He's invited to that one, and that'll be in April. And we did lose Sergeant Board. If the readers who are on the internet right now, who are on that website, will go over to one of the buttons at the top called Ike Talk. You'll get an idea there of the pictures of the people we're dealing with here, the pictures of the various people. We have Kirkland there, and today, how he looked in 1955 at the top there, and we're on the Ike Talk button on the UFO Crash Book website, and we're talking here about the two pictures at the top of the page called Live Witnesses, and then Sergeant Wyckoff's the next one, He was the tail gunner that came back in the Korean War and was a freight specialist. And he's the one that saw Eisenhower land, his plane land, and also heard him talk. The next series of photos there onto the Ike Talk button on the website is the gentleman who was nicknamed the electrician, and he came down that pole so fast. And you can look over there and see why he came down the pole fast, because right behind him is a UFO. And they didn't know that they were extraterrestrial, but he thought it was remote controlled and was going to knock the pole over. That was why he was coming down. Apparently, he'd heard people shouting and screaming and running away. And when you go up a pole, you're a lineman, you've got to be very careful to make sure that you're not facing the sun. And the sun could blind you to grab a hold of a hot wire or something. So he had gone up the pole with his back to the sun, and of course that put him his back to the opposite direction of the runway. Well, apparently this second UFO, the one he saw, was sort of riding shotgun for the one out on the tarmac, out on the runway where Eisenhower was meeting. We think the meeting happened probably between 9:30 and 10:30 on that morning of the 12th.
I have a question that was sent to me from our virtual auditorium. Do you think that whatever happened at Holloman influenced Eisenhower when he gave his warning about giving up too much power to the military-industrial complex in his last speech?
Yes. I think he was sort of formulating all of that material in his mind, and he probably was greatly influenced by the fact that this was that there was a group of people emerging who would benefit financially from keeping this material quiet, and that would be he was in a position to see that. As a matter of fact, he had his first heart attack in September of that year. Of 1955, and he was laid up for 6 weeks in Denver. And then, I think what the question is, what was he doing aboard the UFO? And we can only guess at it, but we think that the extraterrestrials had made some kind of a contact with him, and that they were very, very concerned about our nuclear testing. Eisenhower, at his initiative, and I believe the British at the time, helped set up what was known as the Geneva Conference, the name for it in a minute, in July of 1955. That was the first peace conference we had after the Korean War, which ended in 53, and an international conference. So actually, he started the peace talks at Geneva in July of 1955, and there were the Red Chinese were involved. The mainland Chinese were there. The Taiwanese, which is still there now, by the way, was Formosa never did get invaded. It's still Taiwan, and so then we had Russia was there, Britain was there, we were there, and we were talking about trying to reduce nuclear testing. I think that might have had some reason for him being at Holloman.
I know you've done a lot of research into what everybody calls the Roswell incident, the Roswell crash. You center mainly on the object involved that night that went down on the plains of St. Augustine. But do you think that Eisenhower had been briefed on that and knew the whole story behind what happened in New Mexico in July of 48?
Well, I think all of those presidents in those days did. As a matter of fact, the astronaut we talked about a while back, Ed Mitchell, said that he had heard that John Kennedy was the last one briefed. And that's significant when you consider that John Kennedy, Eisenhower, preceded, was before Kennedy. And before that, Eisenhower was Truman. So if there were only four presidents briefed, we know Truman knew about it because he set up some of the secrecy. Eisenhower was the next one, and my guess, he's the logical one to have met and had dealings with... Barker's, I thought I had a Barker's Bazinga here, and it sounded like he's making all kinds of noise here. It was probably those four presidents, but if Kennedy was the last one briefed, then the others may have found out about it in other ways. But Eisenhower was quiet, had said similar things in other talks. And if the reader would like to scroll down to the website a little bit lower, they'll see some of the things that Eisenhower said along those lines. I think he was formulating those thoughts in those days that he spoke about about the military-industrial complex when he retired.
Also, Richard Nixon was Eisenhower's vice president. Do you think maybe he knew
we're pretty sure he did. As a matter of fact, we think he took another entertainer, Jackie Gleason, to a Homestead Air Force Base, I believe somewhere in Florida, where they had some captured aliens. And Gleason was apparently quite shook up over this. And over the fact that we know that here were these bodies and so forth, I think Nixon was briefed on this. If I could put in a plug here, we do have a book on the plane to San Augustine crash. It is available if you say on the buzz around on the website there. It's UFOCrashBook.com. And we deal also have a CD on that too, and we just finished it last year. It's very new, and there's a lot of material in there that is similar that has an effect on Roswell. They didn't talk about two crashes. We think we found the second one, and a lot of scientific material we found there, and the things we found on the ground, and foil, and all kinds of other things that are pictured there. So. They want to go back to the other website called, it's a homepage, and the other website, actually there's two websites we have, the Eisenhower section and then the Plains of St. Augustine section. Anyhow, they can see some of the material we found there, those who want to get on the internet if they hear this. And then we are available to speak if anybody would pay our expenses. We'll go anywhere and talk about this material.
One other question that was sent to me too was wondering: do you think that Eisenhower and Nixon discussed the subject at all?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. They weren't close, and I think that they had a good working relationship with the president and vice president. But my understanding is that socially they were not close. And it may be that because of the national security involved here and high degree of secrecy that at least they had probably the same people briefing them to make sure that Nixon knew about it, you know, in case anything happened to Ike. And probably Eisenhower had that heart attack in September of '55 in Denver. It would have been very good to have had Nixon up to speed on this material because it was important to know. Roosevelt made the mistake of not telling Harry Truman about the atomic bomb, and he found out about it after Roosevelt died. So presidents are not necessarily close to the vice presidents, but I think probably when it came to important matters, that my guess is at least they had the same people who were giving them briefings, and so they had the same information. Whether they discussed it or not, I have no way of knowing.
I have another question that was sent to me. Get it scrolled here where I can read it. Are you ever considering putting out a book on the Holloman incident and Eisenhower? Your research is really good and would most likely make a good read.
Well, it's been a good research, too. I'm having fun with this one. We're going to probably try to have something out this year. And when I do, I'll get a hold of you, Dean. You might want to make an announcement to other people.
Sure.
And if they write me at my website, let me get my email here, if you don't mind.
Certainly.
Okay, I'm at ArtC, A-R-T-C, while you get your pencil, A-R-T-C, at Conpoint, C-O-N-N-P-O-I-N-T, .net. And I'll be glad to, I have a list of people who have made similar requests, and we're putting it out kind of to see how it, running up the flagpole, if anybody salutes it kind of thing. We are getting some good vibrations on this Eisenhower piece. It can't be as long as a book, but we might have a nice four or five chapters and quite a bit of material that you see there. And we've got more to add to it. I got a lot more photographs from our Air Force One people put in there. So, yes, we will have something out. Not probably within 6 months or so, but we'll have something out this year.
Oh, interesting. That would be one I'd definitely want to put into my UFO book library. I'm getting quite a collection here between David and I.
Well, I'm sitting here under a shelf of them, and I've got about a shelf 10 feet long sagging in the middle, with so heavy with UFO books. That it's interesting that... this is real new information, and half of the hour on Roswell or something, you know, happened, and or somebody's take on it. So there's a lot of people out there doing a lot of writing, but the bottom kind of fell out of the publishing, UFO publishing, about long before the economy went sour. The publishers, I had trouble getting a publisher for my other book. And I'm just putting it out myself now to like find a publisher. So the crash on San Augustine is, by the way, a spiral-back book. It makes it easy to read. You can fold it over and carry it on an airplane or a bus or wherever you're going to go. But I haven't got a publisher to do a hardback or anything yet. But I have some real good feelers, and I'm getting some good, lots of information from a lot of my books have been sent to Canada and England. For some strange reason, so we'll work on that angle a little bit.
Well, I'll be sure and keep my eyes open for it when it comes out. The Eisenhower deal. I can't wait to get on to that one. That one's going to be a really good read.
We've got some more material. I took was working on a photograph. This Robert Board, the fellow who's the last one on the right down there on the. Under the Ike Talk, the older gentleman, he had a gold badge that said said Presidential Guard, and it was worn on dress uniforms. They weren't wearing them; they were wearing around and knocking around. But it was worn over the right breast pocket, and it was really sharp-looking thing, about 3 inches high. And I was able to photograph it. I'll have it with that Eisenhower material. And including his photographs, the early days. And I was concerned with Airman Kirtland. I said, how is Ike, you know, that those planes set 10 feet off of the runway? Well, you have a plane coming into the far end of a runway. How is he going to get off, you know? Are they going to lower him down? Well, Board told me that he showed me a picture that he'd had of himself with a ladder. And so when the plane would land, they had a ladder kind of much wide at both ends, kind of like that one you see that folds in all kinds of configurations on television.
Mm-hmm.
And they had it was wide at both ends, and they would taxi up to wherever they're going to have the red carpet. They'd put the stairway there for the president, the party to come off of, and these guys are sneaking off the front end of the plane. Off of, on a ladder, running around and standing guard. So when he walks down, he has these two guards in front, two guards on each side of the gangway. So he said, "Well, here, I'll show you a picture of it." And And he said, they carry, all planes carry a ladder. That's how we get in and out. But those commies, they're called constellations, apparently had a fairly high door. And it was an 8 or 9 or 10 feet there, so I guess they must have, how did I get out of the plane and walk over the UFO? Well, apparently he used that ladder. There's all I could come up with it.
Oh, man. My mind is just staggering over this whole incident. You know, it's like I'm familiar with the incident of the year before, but this one is just amazing, the way he slipped away from the press and everybody. And
yeah, we mentioned where he had made the announcement that he's going to go hunting, and I think people were hunting in a little crisis, and talk about a relaxed man. Well, apparently this meeting had been set up in advance, and it was important enough for him to go to Holloman and have it. So I think they were quite happy to see that bad weather bug come into the quail hunting scene in Georgia, because that gave him a good excuse for not being around the scene for a couple of days. At least he certainly was seen at Holloman, because we're trying to locate more people who saw him. The military people are quite mum about it, quite quiet about it. But there's still civilians living there who may have been working at the base. And we might run on to another electrician or somebody else who saw or heard him speak at one of the hangars. So, the
well,
fact
you
that
know
he
what?
Was,
we have completely run out of time.
Well, it's been very enjoyable.
I've enjoyed it myself. I've learned quite a bit tonight. And on that note, since we are all out of time, I'd like to thank everyone for joining us tonight and everyone for tuning in. And all of those here in our Pal Talk auditorium, all been really great. I want to thank Mr. Campbell again for being such a great guest on the show this evening. Stay tuned for Voice of the People, hosted by November Hansen. Tonight, her guest is author Frank Joseph. And also concerning the football game tomorrow, go Cardinals!
Go Cardinals!
Join us again next Saturday on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network for another episode of Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. Until then, keep an eye to the sky. Good night, everyone.